This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww.
What happened?
Oh, good. You're awake. I've never been happier to lose a $5 bet.
Where am I?
You're in hospital. Don't worry. Everything is going to be okay.
I remember... You said something... You said you were baking something?
Ah, yes. The lemon meringue surprise. It didn't go well.
There was this blinding light.
Yeah, that was a surprise.
And then intense heat all around me.
Yeah, but don't worry. Your eyebrows will grow back, so it'll be fine.
What's this surgical scar?
So while you were unconscious, I gave them consent for you to become a living kidney donor. You saved a life, and you can have a perfectly normal lifespan with only one kidney. They've done studies on this.
Why didn't you donate your own kidney?
Shh, 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 shh. You're still delirious from the medication.
Stop stroking my head, you weirdo. Get me out of here.
Ah, because of the risk of nosocomial infections. Smart.
No, because... Wait, what?
Yeah, this place is crawling with bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. It's basically a charnel house for prokaryotes. You'll be lucky to get out of here alive.
Ah! Show about medicine.
Recorded in sterile conditions.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Lavos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're going to look at the evidence behind medical topics. And the show is...
Wait. No, I want to say it.
I want to say it.
I want to say it. I came up with it. It's the body of...
Body of evidence.
It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to another edition of The Body of Evidence, the show that survives all pastry-related catastrophes to bring you up-to-date medical information.
Pies can be deadly.
That is true, except in Polish, where the word P-I-E-S means dog, and we all know that doggos are very good boys.
They are indeed very good boys.
Well, today, as I wait for the doctor to bring me my discharge papers, we are talking about nosocomial infections, which is when your doctor tries to kill you with an infection that you catch in the hospital, rather than trying to kill you with exploding custard.
A much more efficient strategy.
That voice hovering over my hospital bed is that of Dr. Christopher Lavos, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and because I forgot to change my paperwork, still my emergency contact and surrogate decision maker in a medical emergency.
And that voice of utter ingratitude is my friend and co-host Jonathan Jarry, podcaster, science communicator, and man who even with one kidney is useful to me in the transactional sense.
Good to hear it. Anyway, today we are talking about nosocomial infections, and we should probably start by defining that term and explaining why it's different from a iatrogenic infection.
Right. So nosocomial infection means an infection you caught in hospital, or more accurately, in some type of healthcare setting. That's what the word nosocomial means. Although we now tend to talk about healthcare-associated infections, or HAIs, because there's a lot of different types of healthcare institutions beyond traditional hospitals.
You mean like long-term care homes, rehab facilities, convalescent homes, and all that?
Exactly. So healthcare-associated infections is a much more broad term to reflect that reality.
And how does that word nosocomial differ from iatrogenic, I-A-T-R-O-genic?
Yeah. So technically, iatrogenic would mean caused by a doctor or some other healthcare professional through a deliberate act or treatment, whereas a nosocomial infection is often the result of simply being in hospital where the environment lends itself to becoming infected by bacteria, viruses, especially ones that are resistant to common antibiotics or antivirals or antifungals.
And this is a big problem in hospitals.
Yeah, I mean, it increases the risk on patients. It's a huge drain on resources because it prolongs hospital stays and it delays procedures and it causes a lot of problems.
I feel like somebody should do something about this. And of course, I mean you specifically.
So people have tried. Now, in the US, Medicare did take a big step in 2008. They said they were no longer going to pay for hospital-acquired infections.
So for people who don't know how the U.S. system works, or doesn't...
If you're rich, it's fine.
Yes. For all the criticism we level at it, if you are over 65 in the U.S. and don't have private insurance, you're covered by Medicare, which actually has huge power to decide what to cover, and what it will fund.
Right. So when Medicare in the U.S. decided that it was no longer going to reimburse hospitals for costs incurred by hospital-acquired infections, that was a huge deal.
Because now there was a financial incentive for hospitals to prevent these infections because it was costing them money.
Exactly.
Did it work?
It did. I mean, infections decreased after the policy was implemented.
Okay, great. So greed is a great motivator.
To be fair, it usually is. Now, to be fair, infection control is a whole field in medicine, and there's a lot of work being done in the field by multiple different stakeholders.
And I imagine that when you put a bunch of sick people together in one place, you're creating a situation where infections are just going to happen.
Exactly. Now, some of this is just a consequence of medical care. If people have indwelling catheters, well, that's a foreign object that's entering the body and is a pathway for infection. The longer someone is on a ventilator, the more likely they are to get pneumonia. That's just inevitable. So obviously, the way to prevent a ventilator-associated pneumonia is to get someone off a ventilator, but, you know, saying it doesn't just make it happen.
Yes, wishing something to be true doesn't make it true. Otherwise, you would have been transferred to Wyoming long ago, is the joke that you wrote here. That still doesn't really work for me. But anyway, so is that what we mean by hospital-acquired infections then? Like just infections associated with catheters?
Well, not exclusively. It means any infection, really. But there are certain types of infections that are recorded for research and monitoring purposes. And because there are, you know, more or less universal reporting standards, tracking certain types of infections allows you to compare different hospitals in different countries to see who's doing well and who's doing poorly, and to see what policies work and what policies don't.
And so what kind of things are we talking about?
So we're usually talking about infections after surgery, urinary infections because someone has a urinary catheter, bloodstream infections because they have a central line.
And by that, you don't mean an IV, do you?
No, a central line is a catheter in one of the major central veins. You know, usually either the jugular vein in the neck or the subclavian vein in your chest. I mean, rarely you can put a femoral line in the groin, but that is particularly prone to infection, so people try to avoid that as much as possible, unless it's an emergency. And, you know, a peripheral vein in your arm, yes, that can become infected, but it's usually not serious. And, you know, once you notice it and remove the IV, then that usually fixes the problem.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, surgical site infections, infections from urinary catheters, blood infections due to central catheters, ventilator-associated pneumonia, C. difficile, and infections due to antibiotic-resistant bacteria is what we're usually talking about.
Wow. I mean, there are a lot of things trying to kill you in a hospital. And here I thought from watching The Resident that it was only the chief of surgery trying to hide his multiple sclerosis symptoms.
There are indeed many things trying to kill you in the hospital. However, it's worth pointing out that decades of improvements in infection control have made things a lot better than they were in the past. Many policies have been implemented over the years to minimize all these things. When I was in training, you know, part of our responsibilities as senior residents was to go around the ward and check for these things.
Like do people often have catheters they don't need? Oh, geez, you're serious.
I am. No, listen, often someone has a catheter inserted when they first come into the hospital because they're sick. And if you're unconscious, you need a bladder catheter. Otherwise, you'll keep wetting the bed. And actually, that puts you at more risk for bed sores, which is another hospital-based complication. But, you know, at some point, people recover and they may not need that catheter anymore. But if nobody did a reassessment, then you have an indwelling catheter that is no longer necessary and just serves as an infection risk.
I now understand why you kept asking if I had trouble urinating when we first met. All right, so when we come back, we're going to look at what we can actually do about hospital or healthcare-acquired infections. That's after the break. Step into our audio-only time machine and revisit past episodes of the podcast. Here's a clip from episode 73 on fibromyalgia.
Okay, so people familiar with the diagnosis may be aware of the concept of tender points. In the 1990 ACR classification criteria, there were 18 tender points. For example, the middle of the shoulder blade, on the side of the elbow, the bony prominence of your hip. And so you had to probe each of these points. And if 11 out of 18 points were tender when you palpated them, then that was a diagnosis of fibromyalgia.
Was that easy to do in clinic, like probing the patient and asking, does this hurt? How about this?
So no, it was actually wildly impractical. And the idea of tender points has actually been retired.
All of our episodes are available at bodyofevidence.ca and wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to the show. Welcome back, podcast listeners. Today we are talking about nosocomial, or more accurately, healthcare-associated infections. Now, let's talk about what measures work for preventing hospital-acquired infections, because if there's one thing you can be certain about, if something costs money, large corporations will find a way to get rid of it.
Now, even in public institutions, nosocomial infections prolong hospital stays and worsen outcomes and drain resources that could be better used elsewhere. So there is both a selfish and a selfless reason to care about this.
Which is true about most things in life.
It is. Now, first and foremost, we need to talk about hand hygiene. So, wash your hands.
How good are doctors at washing their hands?
Not great.
Right, so it's you and restaurant employees then.
Sadly, yes. But there are things that you can do to improve compliance in a hospital setting.
Yeah, threats of physical violence, or maybe a doggo-based reward system.
Both valid suggestions, but one very easy thing you can do is put alcohol dispensers around hospitals. Alcohol hand disinfectants are sort of equivalent to hand washing with soap and water, and a little bit easier. You don't need a sink, you don't need to dry your hands, you can put a dispenser anywhere without needing pipes? Well, almost anywhere.
Why almost anywhere?
Well, there are actually rules, or more like standards, of where they should be. They have to be a certain height from the ground to make them easily accessible. They have to be far away from soap so you don't get the soap and the alcohol dispensers mixed up, which has happened to me, by the way. They always have to be on the right-hand side of the patient's room.
I see that the right-handed bias is alive and well in medicine.
It is. And of course, there are safety considerations about how to protect them from patients.
Protect them from patients?
Yeah, because when patients go into withdrawal, sometimes they drink the alcohol from the dispensers.
That happens?
It does, yes. Anyway, so there's guidelines of where to place them, but they are obviously easier to install than sinks because no pipes. And it's generally quicker and easier for people to use them, which means they are more likely to clean their hands, and that is a good thing because they are roughly equivalent to using soap and water.
You've said roughly equivalent twice now.
You're right. So alcohol-based products will kill a lot of things, but they won't kill all nosocomial infections. For example, they won't kill C. diff.
Suboptimal, and C. diff is a bacterium that we will get back to. Disinfecting your hands with an alcohol-based rub is not going to do anything if your hands are soiled, like visibly soiled.
That's right, yes.
So exactly. You're not cleaning your hands, but you're disinfecting your hands.
Exactly.
What about not wearing jewelry or watches or accessories like that? Even ties, does that help?
So, maybe. So clothes, jewelry, stethoscopes, our phones, pagers, because we still carry those, all of that stuff gets contaminated with bacteria and other germs. That's clear. What's not clear is whether they, in and of themselves, contribute to hospital outbreaks and make people sick. The consensus is that we should avoid things like artificial nails, watches, ties, long sleeves, and unnecessary accessories. But there's still no clear data that it makes a difference. It makes sense, but there's no data to back it up. Still, campaigns to be bare below the elbow are fairly common in many hospitals.
No exceptions to that rule?
They frequently make exceptions for wedding rings because apparently some hospital administrators realize the repercussions of giving people an excuse to take off their wedding rings at work.
So that's what staff can do. What about the hospital or just healthcare institution as a whole?
Well, the system level stuff is also fairly basic, but also quite fundamental. I mean, a big source of the spread of nosocomial infections is sharing equipment. So if you switch to disposable single-use equipment, then that helps limit the spread of antibiotic-resistant organisms from one patient to another.
That, however, does not sound great for the environment.
It's not. I mean, look, hospitals throw away a lot of plastic, but it does make a difference in reducing hospital infections, so...
Man, I hate when my priorities are contradictory like that.
Yeah, look, it happens. And the other big thing has been the transition from multiple patient rooms, in the large hospital wards of decades past, to single patient rooms. I mean, it's less efficient space-wise, but it makes a difference in preventing the spread of infections in hospital.
Also, I would imagine that patients prefer not sleeping in a room with a bunch of strangers unless they're big fans of youth hostels.
Very much so, very much so. But, listen, the other thing that's also really important is how we clean the hospital hospital beds after the patients go home because you're reusing the same bed that somebody else was in just that morning. So, and when I say cleaning...
It's got that old patient smell.
It's got that old patient smell. Actually, when we were on call, we used to have to sleep in beds that the patients used to use in the morning, and then the staff wouldn't always clean them, and we had... It was a big thing. Sometimes we just... One day I'll write a memoir about... Yeah, patients would die in those beds, and then we had to sleep in them at night. That was not fun. Anyways,
how many times do you see your therapist every week?
Not enough, apparently. The big thing, though, so that's the thing. You got to clean the beds because they're being used, and how you clean the bed between patients is what makes the biggest difference. Now, when I say cleaning, I actually mean three different things, right? And we sort of hinted at this before. There's cleaning, there's disinfection, and there's sterilization. So cleaning means removing visibly soiled material from a surface, usually with soap or water, or more commonly these days with some type of commercially available detergent.
So just basic cleaning like you would do basically at home.
Exactly. Now, cleaning is supposed to be followed by disinfection, which is not the same thing. Disinfection is about killing microorganisms, mostly bacteria, but also viruses and fungi to some degree. And you do that with specific chemical disinfectants.
Right. And then you have sterilization.
Right. Sterilization is the complete elimination of all forms of microbial life.
You mean on medical instruments, not on planet Earth?
Ideally. Now, okay. You can do sterilization a few different ways. You can do it with extreme heat or with chemicals or, I mean, whatever. I mean, there's multiple processes you can use, but the point is the same. It's to kill everything.
Why not just sterilize everything?
So cost and difficulty. I mean, and you probably don't need to sterilize everything. I mean, think about a stethoscope that's only touching skin and it isn't going inside the patient.
Assuming your cardiologist is using it correctly.
Indeed. Now, non-critical
equipment. Open wide, sir.
Yeah. Non-critical equipment like that, like stethoscopes, blood pressure cuffs, that can usually be cleaned with basic low-level disinfection.
Like an alcohol wipe.
Right, exactly, because alcohol will kill most organisms if you clean the surface thoroughly and let it dry for 10 minutes, which is the part that most people tend to forget.
We never have time for 10 minutes, Chris.
No,
never have time.
No.
Gotta
you got to fit as many patients into this day as possible.
Got to get paid.
Yeah. So it'll kill most microorganisms, but it won't kill everything. Like it won't kill tuberculosis. It won't kill spores. So C. difficile has spores, which is why alcohol won't kill it. So in those cases, if you have a patient that had tuberculosis or C. difficile, you have to use stronger stuff. Okay, but for routine use, something cheap and simple like alcohol disinfection is probably enough for most pieces of equipment that are not going inside the patient's body.
Right, but for things that do go inside of you, like a gastroscopy tube or a colonoscopy tube, then you would want a higher level disinfection.
Exactly. You want to use those stronger disinfectants that would kill everything because there is a higher risk of causing infection. And when you talk about stuff that goes into sterile tissue, like scalpels, needles, a heart valve, you know, all of that stuff that's going into your bloodstream, then that stuff has to be sterilized to make sure that you kill absolutely everything on the surface because you're going into the patient's bloodstream and you could easily introduce infection.
Not good enough to just wipe a scalpel on your sleeve like this, I imagine.
Sadly, no.
Mm. Now, this isn't exactly complicated per se, but I could easily see how somebody would use the wrong cleaning product and just not clean something properly.
Yeah, I mean, now you technically should have said disinfect and not clean, but I'll let it slide because I know what you mean. And I think kind of just highlights how imprecise we sometimes are with these concepts. Because you're right, it's complicated. And knowing when to use which cleaning product or which disinfection product is kind of complicated and confusing. And that's how mistakes happen in hospitals.
Kind of weird that people need special training on how to clean beds after patients are discharged, especially if they have discharged themselves in the bed.
Yeah, but yeah. Training makes a difference. I mean, when you implement a cleaning bundle in hospital and, you know, you have feedback and training and all that, compliance improve and infections drop. There was one Australian study that when they introduced a new cleaning bundle implementation, they reduced the rates of VRE infections from 0.35 to 0.22 cases per 10,000.
VRE being vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, so it's a bacterium that is resistant to a particular antibiotic. That study showed a drop in VRE infections, but just VRE?
Yes, because it didn't affect rates of C. diff because, well, frankly, C. diff is more complicated.
It's surprising that some things would work for some bacteria and not others.
Right. Well, you have to remember that, you know, all bacteria and viruses and fungi, I mean, they're all different, and what kills one thing won't necessarily kill something else.
That's what you said earlier about alcohol disinfection being okay for run-of-the-mill stuff, but not more serious things like C. diff.
Exactly. So we have to keep in mind what we're talking about here. Obviously, in a hospital setting, you want to prevent all infection. So if you're doing surgery, you want to keep a sterile field to prevent infections of the surgical wound.
Obviously.
And, you know, if you're talking about respiratory infections like influenza and COVID...
Don't say the C word.
Technically, the C word is cancer.
Well, don't say the other C word. I choose to live in denial. My personal risk of complications is low, and I'm no longer socially obligated to care about other people or think about how my actions affect others. I'm not a vulnerable member of the population, and since I'm never going to get old, I never will be, so there.
But I don't think...
La, 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 la.
Anyways, for respiratory infections, the way to do that type of infection control in hospitals is isolating patients. Negative pressure rooms, masks.
Masks don't work. Several public health officials and government types said so recently.
True, but, you know, look, in hospitals, that BS don't fly. So, masking, isolation, increasingly, we're talking about better ventilation and cleaning the air. All of that stuff is important for infection control in hospitals. I mean, there's a reason we use HEPA filters in hospitals. We don't like to mess around.
Good thing that viruses behave differently in hospitals than in schools, and what's true in hospitals doesn't apply to other buildings where large numbers of people spend long stretches of time.
Well, actually...
La, 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 I don't have children, so what happens in schools doesn't concern me. La, 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 la.
I see. Anyway, infection control deals with all that, with all the, you know, for lack of a better term, run-of-the-mill stuff that can cause infections in hospitals, be they wound infections or UTIs, urinary tract infections, respiratory infections, or whatever. But there's another aspect to this, which is antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Oh, yeah, those guys.
Right. So if you want to limit the spread of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, not just because you don't want to make people sick, but also because you want to limit the prevalence of antibiotic resistance overall, which impacts the effectiveness of antibiotics when you're trying to use them to treat patients.
Because if we don't do something about that, eventually the antibiotics we use today will essentially stop working.
Right, because, you know, you take something like MRSA, which is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus.
Is it MRSA or is it MRSA, Chris?
I have never heard a medical person call it MRSA, only on TV. Everybody I know says MRSA. So anyway, Staph aureus, very common bacteria, sometimes causes skin infections, but often it just sits on your skin and does nothing unless you have an open wound.
And methicillin is a derivative of penicillin, right?
Right. So if the Staph aureus gets past the barrier of your skin and causes an infection and you need to get antibiotics, well, it might be resistant to standard penicillin-based regimens, which is a problem because now you have to resort to things like vancomycin or other antibiotics.
Okay, but I mean, we have options at least.
Right, that's right. But, you know, now you get into something like VRE, vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. Now, enterococci are another type of gram-positive bacteria, and we are seeing more and more strains of enterococci that are resistant to vancomycin. So when you have those infections, you have to resort to rarely used antibiotics, stuff like linelazid, which we don't really use very often otherwise.
So the more we can limit these infections, the more we can limit and hopefully delay the spread of antibiotic resistance.
Right. Now, what's interesting, paradigm-wise here, is that often these bacteria don't make people sick. They just colonize you. So they're sitting there on your skin or in your nose or in your rectum, but they aren't causing an infection. And the point of infection control is that you're trying to limit their spread to other patients down the hall where they might cause an infection.
So how do you identify these patients?
Well, you screen for them. I mean, you take swabs and test these people for bacteria. And when you find them, you isolate those patients from other patients to prevent them from also being colonized.
So you take a sample by swabbing the nose and testing for MRSA or VRE?
Well, nose or the bum.
Sounds unpleasant. Who do you subject to this indignity?
So criteria vary and different hospitals have different protocols, but for sure anybody who's been in hospital recently is probably colonized. Now the question becomes what to do about it. So you can decolonize people.
By making them less British?
No.
But seriously, I was about to ask that. Can't you just kill the bacteria? I mean, not with antibiotics, because I would arguably just make the underlying process worse, but can't you just kill them?
So you can. There are decontamination protocols. There are nasal creams that should kill the MRSA bacteria in the nose, and there are protocols to wash patients with chlorhexidine. That's the disinfectant that is used to clean skin before surgery or medical procedures. And it looks purple if you've ever seen it. It stains everything.
Purple? I thought it was like yellowish orange.
Well, they might make different products. The ones that we always use in the hospital were always purple, and they would stain stain everything if you ever got it on the bedclothes, and then people would get very upset with you.
Okay. So you can just wash the patient with this stuff to kill the MRSA, sorry, the MRSA on their skin?
You can. Now, the evidence for its effectiveness is limited overall. There have been studies where it reduces infections in the ICU, but it hasn't shown a benefit in general medical wards, probably because the overall risk is lower in that more low-risk setting.
Right. We've talked about this before. Treatments are at their most beneficial in the highest risk groups.
Yeah, that's just the way of things.
Now, this was all for MRSA. Sorry, MRSA.
You can say MRSA, it's fine.
I'm just teasing you. Are there similar things for VRE?
So there's no decolonization treatment for VRE. There, you really have to rely on the basics of hand washing, gowns, gloves, isolating patients, and not sharing equipment.
And limiting the use of antibiotics.
Yeah, antibiotic stewardship is key because the more we use antibiotics, the more we promote resistance.
And we need to develop new antibiotics because if bacteria do become resistant to current antibiotics, then we need something to fall back on.
Very true.
What about C. difficile? Because that's another important bacterium that causes hospital infections, but it's not an antibiotic-resistant organism per se.
No, C. diff is hard to kill because it produces spores, not because it's gained resistance to antibiotics that used to be effective, although that is a growing problem too.
Okay, so C. diff is Clostridium difficile.
Actually, they've renamed it to Clostridioides difficile.
Why?
There are some differences between C. difficile and other bacteria in the Clostridium genus, so it was decided that it had to be moved to its own genus.
Well, a rose by any other name can still cause massive fatal diarrhea.
It can.
And it's harder to kill.
Yes, but the basics still apply. Hand washing, isolation, all of that. It does work. But the rules here are a bit different. C. difficile bacteria colonize lots of people. And if you've been hospitalized, there's a good chance that you were colonized by C. diff while you were there. But it will only make you sick and cause diarrhea if you get antibiotics that wipe out the quote-unquote good bacteria in your intestine that keep the C. diff in check. So being judicious with antibiotics doesn't just help reduce the development of resistance long-term, it actually reduces the risk that currently hospitalized patients will get seriously sick with C. diff.
This is all very complicated.
It is, and you need a multi-pronged approach, and you have to address multiple different issues simultaneously, and different hospitals can have different issues. In some places, staff may not be cleaning rooms properly. In some places, the problem might be that hand washing is suboptimal. In some places, there may be too much antibiotic use or people leaving catheters in patients for too long. So you really have to identify the source of your problem and see where the outbreaks are coming from. And sometimes the answer might surprise you, like with sinks. Sinks can be the problem.
No, Chris, you're confused. Sinks are good. That's where people wash their hands. That's a good thing.
Well, no. So see, actually, sinks and drains can be sources of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. They have been linked to outbreaks in ICUs and hospitals.
Ah, that's not good. So what's going on there? You wash off contaminated stuff in the sink and the patient's room, and then...
Yeah, the bacteria, they latch onto the pipes. They grow in the dark, moist environment of hospital plumbing.
Moist.
And then there's splashback, and there's aerosolization of these bacteria when you use the sinks, which causes contamination when the next patient, you know, occupies that room.
So how do you fix that?
Well, you can't, really. You got to rip out the sink. I mean, basically, you have to try to avoid it from happening, because if you pour contaminated bodily fluids into the sink, pouring that stuff down there and not doing the washing up outside the patient's room, well, that's how that happens. But it's a complicated thing because, of course, the instinct is to use the sink that's right in front of you, which is why there is this discussion about should you actually have sinks in the patient's ICU room or not.
Death to all sinks. Okay, so I feel like we need newer ways to kill these bacteria.
Ah, you mean the cleansing power of fire?
No.
Okay, well, there's some very interesting research on UV radiation.
Oh, to give people superpowers to kill the superbugs.
Sadly, no, we haven't figured that part out yet. But the idea is to use UV light to decontaminate patient rooms after a patient is discharged.
And that works?
Yeah, it helps a bit. I mean, the largest study that I saw showed a benefit for VRE infection, not for C. diff. So it's a useful addition, maybe.
No health risks to using UV radiation because, you know, cancer?
So it doesn't appear so, because what they're using is UVC radiation, not UVA or UVB. I mean, UVC is further along the electromagnetic spectrum, and, you know, at low levels, it shouldn't damage human tissue. So it can, in theory, be used safely. Another thing that I've read regarding UVC is that you can use it to disinfect the air.
So for COVID?
Well, yeah, and for most respiratory pathogens, probably. I mean, stay tuned. Not widely used yet, but maybe. We'll see. I mean, and there's also a lot of talk about using copper. Copper has some antimicrobial properties, and some people are pushing for it to be used more in the making of, you know, common high-touch surfaces in hospitals.
It's very complicated, Chris.
It's very complicated, but the basics hold true. I mean, we know what to do. There's a lot of fancy new stuff out there. But the problem with infection control is not the lack of effective cleaning and disinfection products. It's their systematic and proper use. I mean, we don't wash our hands. We don't clean stuff properly. We overuse antibiotics. We need to be better at all that stuff.
So really just getting people to follow infection control protocols in the hospital.
Exactly. You got to be cool and follow the rules.
And for our listeners, here's a little ditty to help you remember the most common healthcare-acquired infections.
Bugs in hospitals, and they are called C. diff, VRE, and MRSA. And Chris doesn't like it when people say MRSA, MRSA, MRSA. It's never MRSA, MRSA, MRSA. There are bugs in hospitals, and they are called C. diff, VRE, and MRSA. And Chris doesn't like it when people say MRSA, MRSA, MRSA. It's never MRSA, MRSA, MRSA.
When we come back, testimonials and marketing material may have convinced you that CBD from cannabis is a wonder drug. A new clinical trial put it to the test to see if it could alleviate the symptoms of advanced cancer. The results after the break. Step into our audio-only time machine and revisit past episodes of the podcast. Here's a clip from our conversation with Tricia Gellis and Jacqueline Joza on CPR and sudden cardiac arrest.
I actually had a cardiac arrest myself when I was just 30 years old. I was at work just like any other normal day, and I was eating lunch with my colleagues, and I don't remember any of this, but They shared the story with me later. They said that I suddenly said, "I don't feel great," and all of a sudden I collapsed and fell to the floor from the table.
And do you remember any kind of malaise before you lost consciousness? Like any sort of how you were feeling when you said those words?
I don't think so.
Wow. Okay.
I don't remember, but I don't think I remember feeling anything. It just all of a sudden, there was nothing.
All of our episodes are available at bodyofevidence.ca and wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to the Body of Evidence. The following comes courtesy of a write-up by Scott Gavura for the Science-Based Medicine blog, and Scott always does very good work shining a light on supplements and other questionable health interventions. There's been a lot of hype over cannabis, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. Cannabis is a plant that contains over 400 different chemicals, and at least 120 of them are cannabinoids. Two of those cannabinoids have been the subject of many studies. First, there's THC, which is psychoactive, and then there's CBD, or cannabidiol. There's a lot of hope that CBD can be used to treat, cure, and alleviate a whole legion of symptoms, including the symptoms associated with advanced cancer.
Yeah.
So what were the researchers looking for in the context of this particular trial?
So their primary endpoint was a questionnaire-based thing, so a very subjective thing about how patients were feeling. And they were looking at a number of different endpoints in terms of pain, fatigue, anything. So it was a constellation of symptoms, and it was more about patients' generalized well-being and quality of life, as you were. And it was subjective, so it was relying on patient reports. There was nothing that they could physically measure, which is the reality of how a lot of these quality of life studies are done, because you have to rely on subjective measures. There's nothing physical that you can measure or evaluate in an objective way.
Were these patients receiving chemotherapy, and could this have potentially been helpful for nausea, for example?
Yeah, so they didn't look at nausea as one of the main endpoints individually. Obviously, okay. If you have nausea, then you're not going to feel, and that's going to affect other things. These were all cancer patients. They were all getting standard palliative care. So they would have gotten all the regular stuff that they would have gotten anyway. So anti-nausea medication, pain medication. So
I see. But on top of that, some of them got CBD.
Right. So they got. So here's the thing. We often call these placebo-controlled trials, and that's sometimes a bit of a misnomer.
Mm-hmm. We don't withhold standard of care from those people.
So everybody got what they would have normally gotten, and then on top of that, you got either CBD or the placebo.
Right.
So that the patients and the researchers don't know who is taking what.
How many patients in each of these groups?
So there were 215 patients in this study. Only 144 ended up getting randomized because some of them were excluded. And so in the two arms, there were 58 who got CBD and 63 who got placebo. So a fairly small study when you look at it from some of the mega trials that we've talked about. We have tens of thousands of patients. But in cancer, it's small. But this is not entirely atypical. Like if you were trying to do a small study on something like this, you often would start with a few hundred patients to see if there's a major thing. So it's a smallish study, but it's not surprisingly small given the usual realities of trying to enroll patients. Because recruiting patients for a study, especially in the developed world, the study was done in Australia. People in the developed world are not that keen to enroll in clinical trials these days. Like, they're not that interested. They have other concerns. And especially when you're talking about palliative care, they're like, look, I've got other issues, right? Mm-hmm. They don't want to, because you got to fill out the questionnaires. There's a lot of time investment that goes into it. So it's very hard to recruit people. So getting that many is, I think, more or less in the standard vein.
I will ask our listeners to place a bet in their head if they think that the CBD was superior to placebo, inferior, or the same, now that you've decided what you think the results were. Mm. Chris, what were the results of this trial?
Basically, there was no difference.
Between
CBD and the placebo.
In
terms of symptom scores, in terms of the patient questionnaire, there was really not much of a difference. And this is not...
Are you surprised?
No, not really, because there is this perpetual, and we've talked about this before, this sort of hype and burst cycle, right? Yeah. Where everybody's like, CBD can cure everything. And then it's like, well, no, it can't actually do this. And then, you have some early non-randomized observational studies that are very sort of interesting.
But it helped my patient. Like, I've got this one patient, really helped him. I think there's something there.
Yeah. So, it's like, but it's just the thing. When you actually test stuff out, you realize not. And again, there could be a biochemical reason. Like, people are like, well, the CBD receptors are responsible for the development of nausea. So theoretically, it should help. Yeah, theoretically, it should. But in a practical sense, when you have people who are being treated properly, there's not that much extra benefits to derive from some of these products.
This thing that you just mentioned of like, well, it could have this effect and bind to these receptors. I've referred to it on Twitter as, and if you have kids listening around, cover their ears for 5 seconds, as a mechanism masturbation.
Yeah.
Which got me a spot on a podcast based on that tweet alone. But yeah, it is this idea that at the end of an N of five study, the researchers spend three paragraphs in this like intellectual onanism of like trying to, but it could bind to this. Like I could trace the path molecularly. I think this makes sense before even having shown that it does work.
Yeah.
It's very easy to come up with a molecular mechanism of how this could work without having shown that it does work.
Yeah.
And here it's important to point out that symptoms improved even in the placebo group.
Yeah.
There were people who got better over the course of the trial in the placebo group, which is why it's so important to have a control arm and see what would naturally happen in order to rule out any non-specific effect of the intervention that we're interested in.
Right. And now we'll do a trivia quiz.
Great.
Listener, what is the name of that phenomenon? Because it has a specific name.
Is it the Hawthorne effect?
The Hawthorne effect, yeah. Mm-hmm. So just putting people in a clinical trial setting, first of all, they just get better quality care because they're being monitored more, right? So people improve just as a consequence of being monitored. So there's that whole, observation effect. But in fact, there's a practical side to it too. If you put people in a clinical trial, they're getting more regular follow-ups, they're getting better care. And I think this just underscores how effective and how beneficial good palliative care can be in improving patients' symptoms. And what we don't always do that well, which is a shame, is that we're not very good at end-of-life care. And this is a universal problem, but patients with cancer, there's no reason why patients with cancer should suffer if we could devote the proper resources and care to them. It's just that often we find ourselves in a situation where we have limited healthcare resources and people are not treated as well as they should.
Is CBD good for anything at the moment?
Well, I mean, I think the strongest evidence is for the epilepsy stuff, right? The genetic cause of epilepsy in kids. There has been randomized trials. I think that is pretty clear. The other stuff is a little bit wishy-washy. I mean, the nausea stuff after chemotherapy, even prior, I mean, this study didn't particularly specifically look at that, but even prior to that, like, there have been small trials where, you know, marijuana, or more accurately CBD oil, was better than placebo, but not actually better than other anti-nausea medications that are on the market. So if you already have a patient in palliative care who's being treated properly, there's probably no advantage to putting CBD on top of that. Could you use it as an alternative anti-nausea medication? Maybe. And again, when you're treating symptoms like this, you're much more, I think, permissive about, well, see if it works or not, right? Because either it'll work or it doesn't, because either nausea will get better or it won't. And if it doesn't work, well, then you switch to something else. It's not like a cardiology trial where the endpoint is 10 to 15 years down the road, where you have to rely on statistics to know the results.
Are nausea meds or anti-emetics well tolerated, or do they have their own side effects?
Some of them have their own side effects. I mean, and not everybody responds to all of them. I mean, some of them make you drowsy. Some of them can have other side effects too. So it's and here's the thing. It's, you try it. You know you have about three or four medications you can try. You try one. If it doesn't work, then you go to the second one. So there is an argument to be made for treating patients empirically and symptomatically, because you're treating symptoms. You're not trying to prevent long-term outcomes where you have to rely on statistics because you can't observe the benefit. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of hype around CBD, but right now a lot of it is just unsubstantiated.
I think a lot of it is unsubstantiated. It probably does have a limited scope of usefulness. I think the epilepsy stuff has been, I think, essentially proven at this point. So you can use it for very specific
refractory childhood epilepsy.
Yes, the name of which escapes me right now. I want to say Dravet syndrome.
I think so.
Yeah.
We mentioned it years ago in the podcast. Yeah.
So, okay. I mean, there are situations where you could use it, you know, as a medication, but as a generalized thing, like, again, a lot of stuff that floats out there, like, it helps with glaucoma, it actually doesn't. I mean, a lot of that stuff is just simply not true, and so it'll have a limited use, but I think a lot of the hype around it is just not valid.
When we come back, media pundits and public health officials may have convinced you that COVID has become endemic and there's nothing we can do but go back to normal. But there's one class of people who disagrees. We talk about the World Economic Forum after this.
Do you like medicine that tastes funny and science made easy? Jonathan and I are so much more than disembodied voices on the internet. Join our Facebook community, follow us on Instagram, and check out our website at bodyofevidence.ca to find all of our episodes as well as our science cartoons. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Labos, and Jonathan is at Cracked Science. Let's fight back against misinformation.
Welcome to the final stretch of the Body of Evidence. The World Economic Forum is a lobbying organization founded by Klaus Schwab in 1971, and every year it hosts a meeting in Davos, Switzerland, not to be confused with Davros, the creator of the Daleks.
Of course.
Their last annual meeting took place from January 16th to January 20th. Some of the many speakers, I looked it up, it included the dean of Harvard School of Public Health, there was a global chief executive of Deloitte, the director of the FBI was there, the minister of economy for Ukraine, actor Idris Elba.
Of course.
The World Economic Forum always attracts these grand conspiracy theories.
Because that's where the Illuminati are.
Yep, those elites that are secretly and not so secretly trying to take over the world. You may have heard the Great Reset conspiracy theory. That was a distortion of a real initiative called the Great Reset. It was drawn up by the forum, for example.
At some point, you're going to have to explain to me why a secretive group would televise an international conference they were hosting. Because I don't see the logic there. But anyways...
That's because they think we're dumb, Chris. They think we're not paying attention. But those brave people with eggs on their profile on Twitter, they're the ones who are paying attention. The rest of us are sheeple, sheeple. But what really made the rounds in January was what could be spotted in pictures from that event. Now, if you watch the videos from the event, you may not notice anything out of place. You see people on stage not wearing a mask and essentially acting as if the pandemic is over, which is not dissimilar from scientific and medical meetings that we have seen post-COVID vaccines. However, as was reported by various outlets, the annual meeting's Guidance on Health Measures document shows that they took COVID much more seriously than those scientific and medical meetings. Mm. It recommended that participants be vaccinated with the latest available vaccines and that they take a COVID test before traveling to Davos, which that's pretty standard, yeah. Right? It's
well, there are not that many travel rules anymore for regular stuff, but right. Yeah.
But like, it's not unusual for any kind of conference to be like, hey, you know, make sure you're vaccinated. We can't enforce it, but you know.
Yeah.
So a little recommendation. Okay, fine. So it's a recommendation. It's not something that they can enforce. But then participants were required to be tested in one of the many forum testing centers after arriving in Davos and picking up their badge. And test results were processed within 24 hours and emailed to the person. Importantly, and I quote, failing to conduct an on-site test or a positive result will lead to the badge being deactivated. And as the badge grants access to the meeting's venues, it means you are locked out of the event if you test positive or if you refuse or forget to test on the premises. Yeah.
Not dissimilar from what the Olympics did, right? The Olympics,
okay.
Yeah, the Olympics were testing their athletes all the time.
I see.
Because, you know, he can't derail the Olympics. That's serious.
Yeah, that's serious business. They also made masks, disinfectant, and COVID self-tests available at the event. The document does specify surgical and FFP2 masks will be provided. What is an FFP2 mask, Chris?
It's just a little bit different than a standard mask. It's not, I don't think it's as good as an N95. Frankly, I haven't really seen them used all that much, okay. So I'm not 100% familiar with them.
On their official transport vehicles for the Davos conference, all drivers were required to wear a mask. The participants also had a dedicated COVID-19 hotline available for advice and support. I'm going to read also from their document. Inside the venues, areas will be cleaned, okay, disinfected, okay, and ventilated several times a day. Additional state-of-the-art ventilation systems have been installed in areas with restricted air circulation, which is what we want to see because COVID is airborne.
Yeah, exactly. It's air filters. This is not complicated stuff.
I also read separately that they had installed far UVC germicidal lamps. We were mentioning UVC in the main part of the show. They had apparently installed those in certain rooms, so that's not in the guidance document itself. As the title of Julia Doubleday's Slate coverage of this states, quote, billionaires at Davos don't think COVID is a cold.
Mm.
Are they right, Chris? He asked, lobbing the softest softball ever seen by humanity.
Well, I mean, COVID is not a cold. I mean, frankly, anything that can kill upwards of 6 million people, should be taken seriously. I mean, yes, the situation is different now than it was in March of 2020 because the vaccines exist. We're not getting as many severe cases, and there's largely been a reduction in serious cases and hospitalizations. All of that is true, but we can still do better. And the things that it takes to do better are not that complicated. And it's really baffling to me why there is this resistance to, you know what, fine. People don't want to wear masks. It hurts your ears. Fine. Like, I can't even argue that point anymore, you know? Why would you object to better air quality in indoor spaces? Like, why would you object to better air quality in schools? You've done tests. You know that the air quality, the CO2 level in a school is above 1,500 parts per million. Nobody is going to argue that that's good for the kids. Why do you think it's okay for kids to be breathing in carbon dioxide all day, let alone the viruses?
We should put lead paint back into the paint at this point.
It's really, and again, you can make, like, there was a thing here in Canada, like, okay, all this public, all the civil servants have to go back to work. I'm like, okay, did you upgrade the office buildings? Like, you know, these giant buildings that have no windows? Like, this is easy to fix.
But that's when the gaslighting starts, right?
Yeah.
So Doubleday that I mentioned, Julia Doubleday remarks that U.S. President Biden said the pandemic was over, mm-hmm. right? He said this in front of cameras.
He did.
And the New York Times, Amy Harmon wrote in an article entitled The Last Holdouts that these renegades are annoyingly refusing to accept continual reinfection as their new normal.
Why is that normal? Like, that's bizarre.
The economy, Chris. We need to go back to normal so that the economy can keep...
One of my favorite arguments, too, is like, you know, the workers have to come back to the office buildings in downtown Ottawa because we need to support the restaurant industry. And I'm like... I here's the thing. I understand what you're trying to say, right? Yeah, I understand that if, you know, the economic consequences of an entire industry failing, that's fine. I think there has to be some degree of soul searching. Like, are you telling me that an entire industry is dependent on people eating out for lunch because they're forced to work downtown? Like, if that's what the segment of our entire economy is based on, I think that's a lot more tenuous than people realize, and maybe we should be diversifying a bit. But it's weird that that becomes the argument that people use. Like, and you want to do that? Fine. Put a freaking air filter in the offices. Like, this is not complicated.
And in
stuff.
The restaurant, I mean, those restaurant workers, if they get sick, they don't show up to work.
I wish, like, had we known this at the beginning, we could have told restaurants to do what dentist offices do. Because when this happened at the beginning, we were told, shut down. You're going to put HEPA air filters.
Because they do aerosolized procedures.
Yeah. 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 And they're like, you have to meet these standards. And they were like, okay. And had we done that at the beginning?
Because there was so much denial about the airborne nature of COVID, dentists couldn't deny it because they were creating aerosols.
Yes.
And so the risk was there. Whereas in other situations, people were like, well, no, it's droplets.
It's droplets. So we just have to keep a 6-foot distance.
So Biden says the pandemic is over. Yeah. New York Times has just so many opinion articles now just denying the reality of the pandemic. Here in Canada, we're not that much better. We had Dr. Bonnie Henry, the provincial health officer for British Columbia, say on January 30th, and I quote, "Everybody wearing masks is not going to make a tremendous difference in the transmission of these viruses." Her reasoning being that there are situations in which we don't wear masks, like when we eat, therefore masks are useless. That one hit you pretty hard, huh?
That was a...
I sent it to you.
I was looking at that and I was just like, what? Now, here's the thing. If you want to make an argument that it's hard to implement a mask mandate, that people are not compliant because freedom... Okay, like, yes, I can understand you're trying to make the argument. But... masks still work. And if you're, and here's the thing, if you're telling me that it's hard to get people to do something, I mean, yes, I guess strategy A is just give up and don't try. But
at this point, what is your role? If you're saying,
yes,
well, I can't do my job because the people won't obey me.
Yeah. So whatever.
Why do we need you?
Whatever. I don't work in a hospital, so I don't have to worry about the hospital becoming overwhelmed. But it's like, I mean, here's the thing. What I love about masks, the whole debate about masks, is it almost completely parallels the debate that we had about seatbelts back in the 1980s, which is like, well, a seatbelt isn't going to prevent all accidents. No, but it'll prevent some accidents, and that helps. It's like, oh, it's not going to prevent if, you know, I'm like T-boned by a truck because it's only stopping me from going forward. You're like, right, but forward deceleration injuries are a significant one. And they're like, oh, I can't wear it because I have a condition. Yeah, I have a heart condition. I can't wear the shoulder strap. And it was like, you know, it's like, I can't wear a mask because I have asthma. I'm like, no, you're the one who should be wearing a mask because you're more at risk for a serious complication if you have COVID. It almost directly parallels it. It's really quite... And here's the thing. It took a while to get people to wear their seatbelts. I remember, I mean, also, it's like my mother would like hate having the shoulder strap. She would get like a clothespin to like put on the seatbelt to give her like more flexibility. She's like, okay. I can't have this tight thing across my... And of course, now people are like, what do you mean? It's just a shoulder strap. It's fine. This is
the weirdest thing. When I was a kid, and sometimes I would take cabs with my mom, and my mom would tell me never to wear a belt in at the back of a cab.
Oh, because she was worried about it strangling you.
No, for her as well. She would not wear one either. Mm. Like we were safer in a cab. Mm. Like, you didn't need one when somebody else was driving. Like, it was the weirdest logic.
Yeah.
But at the time, I think that might have been like a common thing that people were not wearing a seatbelt in cabs. Like, no, it's fine in a cab.
Well, it was also very true that people didn't wear seatbelts in the back seat of a car. Mm-hmm. Now we talked about this in our episode about car safety. Yes, it is a slightly safer thing because if you fall forward, you hit the seat and you don't go through the windshield.
But so risk reduction is a good thing.
Risk reduction is a good thing. And this is the problem. Like, we've gotten to the point where, like, yeah, you wear a mask and they're going to be most beneficial in high risk settings. Will they prevent all infections? No, but they'll prevent most. And, you know, the fact that we still wear them in hospital makes a difference. You would be shocked how many patients I have showing up to clinic actively sick. Like, coughing and sneezing. And I was like, you know, you shouldn't have come if you were sick. You're like, ah, it's just the flu. I'm like, Do you understand that most of my patients are like in their 80s and 90s?
We have normalized respiratory infections.
Well, I mean, they were normalized before, right?
Not now. Like we have always normalized respiratory infections in modern times.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's just a cold. It's just a flu. Well, no, I mean, you're going to make me sick if I catch this. And there are repercussions to that.
There are repercussions to that. And I thought that we had learned that lesson because of COVID, but I don't feel like we have.
I wouldn't call it a concerted effort because I don't really think it's a conspiracy, but there is a momentum that I see that is pulling opinion writers, politicians, and even scientists and healthcare professionals toward denying the complications from COVID and simply accepting it as the new normal and giving the population, rather convincing the population that the pandemic is over while the VIPs of the world going to Davos, as we're mentioning, they get to be protected by the kinds of measures that we need universally. Because those air purifiers and germicidal UV lamps, as you mentioned, we're not getting those for our own children in schools.
Yeah, and I mean, it's...
We could.
It would be so easy. And here's the thing. The whole... Do you remember this term from the pandemic? Personalized public health.
Yes, you've mentioned this multiple times on the podcast. I think you still haven't digested. You're still chewing on it.
But it's like, I mean, here's the thing. It's like when you tell people, look, the pandemic is over, you have to gauge your own risk. You've essentially absolved yourself of responsibility. Because part of declaring the pandemic over or the emergency response over is that you no longer have to provide funding. You no longer have to have a federally mandated sick leave, right? It allows the government to step back from a lot of the admittedly very expensive programs that had to be put in place during the pandemic. But I had hoped that we were going to use the pandemic as a wake-up call to change stuff. Like, you know what? It's important to have paid sick leave for workers. Otherwise, stuff like this happens. Yeah. I mean, not only is it morally right to have some degree of human compassion, right, for when people are sick, but there's an economic benefit to it. I thought that realizing that we could work from home would make it easier for people to have more flex time. But it's like there's this incredible resistance. And I have patients. I tell all my patients, we can do a lot of the visits virtually. Like, you do not have to physically come in. 90% of them want to come in.
Wow.
Just to be told that their test results are normal. And my secretary will tell them, all you're doing is coming in to close the file, and they still physically come in.
Wow. You mentioned personalized public health. Yeah. I think George Orwell is stepping out of his grave and busy taking notes. Greg Gonsalves, speaking of George Orwell, Greg Gonsalves, writing in The Nation about this, made a reference to George Orwell's Animal Farm. And he wrote, he quotes Orwell, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others, would be a fitting motto for the current COVID response in the U.S., Gonsalves writes, the milk and apples that Napoleon, Snowball, and Squealer consume in George Orwell's Animal Farm are today the luxuries of MERV 13 ventilation systems, UVC lights, rapid tests, bivalent boosters, Paxlovid on speed dial from your concierge physician, working from home, and generous paid sick leave. Yeah. And I find it quite revealing that most of the people who address misinformation and disinformation seem to have stopped at anti-vaccine propaganda on the subject of COVID, right? They recognize that the vaccines are safe and effective, and they fight for that. Mm. However, I'm not hearing a whole lot from those people on the very important topic of the denial of the airborne nature of COVID-19 and of the need to improve our air by a lot of people in positions of power who keep those measures for themselves and then gaslight the rest of the population right into thinking that they don't need them. COVID is endemic now. You'll be fine. You're replaceable.
Yeah, because it's hard. And it's like, who do you go to improve? Because I don't know who to go to improve the ventilation status of a building. Like, you'd go to an engineer. Like, if you had an office building and somebody said to you, improve the ventilation, how would you do that? You probably can't.
Well, there are HVAC companies that specialize in this.
Yeah.
Now, of course, redoing the whole, I mean, you know, when you had the minor flooding in your building, you saw how complicated that was to fix.
Took me like 3 months because there was water damage in the wall behind my closet. Like, it was the most minor thing ever. And I was like, we gotta plaster it. Yeah. Who knows how to plaster a wall these days? here's the thing. This is the problem. Like, we built these buildings to be environmentally friendly, meaning less heating costs, right? And more fuel efficient. Mm-hmm. So we didn't burn energy heating them. So we made them essentially airtight boxes, which is not great for for COVID. So now we have this real tension because if your process is going to be sucking in air from the outside and pushing out air to the outside, that's going to make a building less fuel efficient heating-wise. So there is a trade-off there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a question of like, well, how do you find that trade-off? And I mean, again, my very simplistic understanding of the situation is, well, you filter the air using a filtering system, but that's complicated. You got to install it, right?
Yeah. And you need to have enough air changes in the room.
There's a very simple sort of do-it-yourself model, which is you get one of those portable air filters that you can get at any sort of like bulk outlet, like Costco or whatever the equivalent in your area is.
Or home improvement stores online, Amazon, of course.
But that's sort of like the equivalent of having space heaters in every office rather than having central heating. I mean, it's a good short-term solution, but it's not a long-term solution. But we have to do it, and it's like no one's doing it because I don't understand why. It doesn't make sense to me.
Because Chris, you're replaceable. You're not part of the Davos elite. It is now time for the best part of the show. It's not Twitter, but it'll do.
I think the best part of the show is the opening skits, but you will let us know.
Where we share things we liked and were involved in anticipation of the collapse of our favorite social media platform. Some of our listeners have been waiting for us to do a special episode on so-called complementary and alternative medicine like homeopathy, acupuncture, chiropractic, and while that may still happen...
And we sort of touched upon that. We touch upon them peripherally in the context of other stuff.
We've interviewed a few people about... We've had Ryan Armstrong about chiropractic years ago. So we've touched some of these things here and there. But I did speak about all of that for an hour and a half on the Yoga Meets Movement Science podcast. Link in the show notes if you're interested. I also wrote about the demonization of oxalate in the diet. This is something that's come up recently because of the publication of a book by a woman claiming that we should all be on a low oxalate diet to cure all kinds of diseases.
Unless you're trying to cure kidney stones.
Even there,
I'm not sure.
Even there, if you look at the
well, it
guidelines,
depends on which type. There's many different types of kidney stones, and it's very variable.
But even with an oxalate-based kidney stone, which is the majority of kidney stones, if you look at the American and Canadian guidelines on how to treat that, none of them endorses a low oxalate diet. They go, well, try to avoid high oxalate food. But even that, it's like, you know.
Well, it's like gout. Maybe don't gorge on bear liver, you know? Like don't actively make the problem worse. I mean, it's largely genetic, the amount of uric acid in your blood, but don't go and start eating organ meat. So you're not helping the situation.
So anyway, so I wrote about, you know, all this hype, this unsubstantiated hype around the low oxalate diet. My article is linked in the show notes. And if our coverage of Davos and its COVID precautions got your blood boiling and you would like to keep your blood boiling for some reason, I would recommend you listen to the December 22nd, 2022 episode of the Death Panel podcast entitled COVID Year 3.
I listened to that when you sent it to me.
What did you think?
I liked it. It was an interesting... It was a...
demoralizing, it was comprehensive.
It was an insightful take on, I think, the current situation.
Yeah, the American situation specifically. Yeah. It is very much an American podcast, but looking at the reality of COVID in the U.S. in year three versus what politicians were saying, what the media was saying. That was very interesting. Link in the show notes for that as well. Chris, anything you want to plug in this segment?
What's come up recently for me? My last article was about the new alcohol guidelines, which were not actually alcohol guidelines. They were a position, not even a position statement. They were a scientific communique. I don't know what you want to call it because they weren't actually, because they weren't
paper.
Telling people what to do. They were basically talking about how the risk of alcohol-related illness goes up at a very, very low level. So
it is very interesting that we did an episode on red wine way, way back, episode 7, I think, where you were saying there's no such thing as a health benefit to low levels alcohol consumption. And we got some flack from that from a few people.
Oh, yeah.
One of whom is, I think, an alcoholic friend of mine. But anyway, there was a lot of flack about this at the time and a lot of people pushing back. And now, in the past few months, all of a sudden, some people and journalists are waking up to the fact that, no, there is no quantity of alcohol consumption that is healthy for you.
Although there was one local cardiologist who went on the media and was like, I think this prevents heart attacks.
Oh, wow. Okay. Bring the data, buddy.
Yeah, bring the data. He's like, I think this is true. I think a little bit of wine is good for you. And I'm like, okay.
He said while sipping on his rosé.
Almost.
By the way, I have a vineyard. Called Johnson Vineyard, and
So I wrote an article about that for the Gazette, talked about it on CTV with Mitsumi Takahashi. So that's a segment that you can find when I remember to post them online, which I sometimes forget because I forget about social media. And I'm going to be doing a few other lectures on alcohol, which sort of like all these things sort of like happened at the same time. One for the McGill Cares program, so talking about alcohol and dementia, and then another one for McGill staff about, you know, public health stuff. And it's going to be, so we're talking a lot about alcohol these days. And if you want to go look at the article, you can see my argumentation for the fact that there is no U-shaped curve. There is no protective benefit to alcohol. The French paradox is a slightly outdated and statistical anomaly that doesn't actually exist in the real world.
Because some of the people who drink alcohol were told to stop drinking alcohol because they were sick.
That's right. And there's been newer research recently that used conventional and genetic analyses to compare. And you see, you know, when you do the conventional analyses, you see the U-shaped association. There's the U-shaped curve, like, oh, the risk goes down at the moderate levels. And then you do a genetic thing that sort of can eliminate all of those confounders. And it just, it looks very linear. It's a very straight line. It's, you know what, it's not good
you
for
you.
You
were right.
Yeah, I was right.
You were right.
I'm waiting for my parade.
We want to thank patrons of the show who upped their pledge. We've got Warren and we've got Brian and Terry. Thank you very much. We've got new patrons or returning patrons for some of them. There's Chris Roos, Dave Lansing, Hired Goon, Jari-Pekka Lehtinen. I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly. Mike Leipi, and Andrea. We want to thank Ian for his regular PayPal contribution. We want to thank all of our patrons, but especially those at the $5 or more level. And they are Alan, Barb, Bill, Brian and Terry, D, Dan, Dave Lansing, DJA, Don, L, Frank, Jeff, Grace, Hired Goon, Isabel, Islan, Jean-Nicola, Jeff, Joanne, John, Juan, Caitlin, Carrie, Ken, Leanne, Leon, Leslie, Louise, Luna, Lindsay, Marianne, Mark, Mary, Mavis, Miriam, Ms. Bean, Nolan, Olga, Pascal, Pat, Paul, Rina, Robin, Ronald, Rice, Scott, Sky, That Bunch of God, Trimin, and Warren. If you want to help support our show, go to bodyofevidence.ca/about and you will see two options. You can make a donation through PayPal or you can become a patron on Patreon, either making monthly contributions or an annual contribution. And when you become a patron for as little as $1 a month, you get access to a patron-only bonus segment each month called Digressions. And this month's Digressions will be on...
To be determined. No, we're going to be answering questions that we got from some of our patrons about nosocomial infections. And if time permits, which it may, we're going to touch upon another study that you might have heard of, recently promoted by the governor of Florida, suggesting that the more COVID vaccine doses you get, the more likely you are to get sick. I was trying to ignore this thing because this becomes exhausting after a while, but we are going to talk about that so you can defend yourself against somebody who tries to convince you that more vaccines are bad. And we are going to explain a very, very interesting statistical phenomenon, which you will learn about if you subscribe.
It's self-defense for the mind.
That's right.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our jingle was composed and performed by Joseph Hackle. You can find his music at josephhackle.bandcamp.com. Check the show notes for full music credits. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackle. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy. Proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at the
body of evidence.
Mercer, Mercer, Mercer. It's never Mercer, Mercer, Mercer. There are bugs in hospitals, and they are called C. diff, V-R-E, and M-R-S-A. And Chris doesn't like it when people say MRSA, MRSA, MRSA. It's never MRSA, MRSA, MRSA.
They said they were no longer going to pay for hospital-acquired infections.
You sound like you're on cocaine right now.
That's right. I'm like the cocaine bear, which I still think is the greatest movie ever produced.
I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't seen it, but still, the concept is brilliant.
True story.
True story.
Slightly exaggerated, though.
Ah, it's the stuff.
Okay, just tone it down a little bit. Just a little bit.